Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and today's conversation is with Dr. Ward Cassells, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Terry Ergens. Dr. Cassells, I understand your focus these days is not just the wars, but you're also involved in a fair amount of humanitarian and disaster relief, both here in the U.S. as well as abroad. Tell us a bit about your organization's involvement in global humanitarian and disaster relief efforts. And if I may, to what extent does this support represent an extension of U.S. soft power in the form of medical diplomacy and building bridges to peace?
Well, Al, you've heard Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and our Joint Chiefs Chairman, Admiral Mullen, say that we cannot kill our way to success in Iraq and Afghanistan, that we really have to have the majority of the populations there believing that we are a force for good. And there are other areas of the world where we hope we can intervene before a crisis becomes conflict and try to diffuse that. The types of soft power involved are not necessarily medical. They may be helping to stand up, you know, educate and establish a law-abiding police force. That's a critical element. Roads that work, markets that work, clean water, sanitation, so there's no, you know, not contaminating your water with human waste. These are critical for any society. But healthcare has a special role in these. We're talking about places where typically the NGOs, the non-governmental humanitarian organizations, can't always go. They may be precluded from getting there by logistical efforts. For example, in the Pakistan earthquake a few years ago, in the Indian Ocean tsunami, we had the lift capacity, the logistics capacity, helicopters and so forth can get you to high altitudes or when roads are washed out. Only the U.S. military can do this. When we do so, it changes the population's attitudes about the U.S. And this is why Admiral Mullen calls our fleet of hospital ships, these are the most powerful ships in his Navy because they serve to win hearts and minds and prevent conflict or to tip the balance in conflict by winning the, you know, the bulk of the populace to our side. All that sounds good. It's not so easy to effect in practice. For example, in Afghanistan, there's a certain amount of corruption. You can't necessarily just pour money into the government. At the same time, if you go in and just do it yourself, you might embarrass the local doctors because they feel like they don't have the technology. They may leave the village out of embarrassment. We've seen this happen. So the tricky thing for us is to build local medical capability subtly, humbly. If we can, we work with the government. But if the government is diverting the funds elsewhere, why, we have to work directly with the village elders. Now, this can work very well on the local level. If you go in to a village and you treat a village elder's granddaughter, grandson in particular, they're crazy about male heirs, or you treat a lame animal so that it can pull a plow again, or you build a clinic to that the village chief's specifications, employ his people, put his name or imprimatur on it, you win the whole village. But it's critical that you get that guidance from them as to how they want to do it and not just come in and drop in a prefab, you know, American deal with an American nurse or medic. You can start that way, but it has to be, you have to get buy-in from the village so that they make it their own. We think that this way is a way to do good and do well over there. And in Afghanistan, we're going to need, I think, all of the means at our disposal to win over the population, because when you got bad guys hiding in the village and occasionally have civilian casualties, well, you've got to repair that damage.
And Dr. Cassells, you'd mentioned earlier about Alta being one of your biggest challenges, your tenure. And how about what is the evolution of the electronic health record for the DoD? And I guess specifically, what are your plans to expand the current capabilities of the system?
TERRY, ALTA, which stands for Armed Forces Health Longitudinal Technology Application, was a well-intentioned but overly complex effort to build a gargantuan system that would cover the battlefield and the hospital records here stateside. In trying to build this system using the usual military contractors, we did not know enough about how to design electronic health records. The contracts were not as astutely drawn up as they should have been, and they weren't monitored as with the rigor and accountability that was required. So mistakes were made, but moving ahead, the question is what to do about it. It's a system that is not very popular. We require doctors and nurses to use it because we know that electronic records have the capability to improve the quality of care, reduce mistakes, and to reduce costs eventually. Right now, we're not there. We have a system which is hard to learn and not easy to use. So we've decided to work and learn some lessons from our friends at the Veterans Administration. We're changing our system to use their graphical user interface, which is intuitive and doctor-friendly. With the VA, we are developing interoperability engines, what's called a service-oriented architecture, so that we can begin to have some common functions, not necessarily the same application, but applications that communicate with each other. Our system and the VA system, both are based on an old MUMPS format that needs to be updated. It needs to be, web-based, Java-compatible. To get there, we are relying heavily on the services-oriented architecture. Together with the personal health record, which we think we will eventually empower our doctors to work smarter and more efficiently, and also empower our patients to take more responsibility for their health. But Rome was not built in a day.
Research is in the heart of nearly every major medical and pharmaceutical treatment advancement. Would you tell us more about your military medical research and development efforts?
In the Department of Defense, biomedical research is broken up in several different initiatives. One is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which spends several hundred million dollars on very futuristic breakthrough research. They invent answers for problems that have yet to think about, and that can be very powerful. Of course, ARPANET, the precursor of the Internet, came from that type of research. Then we have research which is requirements-based, driven by the needs of our warfighters. And we run most of that through the Army Medical Research Command at Fort Detrick. Together, we spend about $1 billion a year on research. That's almost doubled in the past 2 years. The research is administered both by me and the Undersecretary for Acquisition of Technology and Logistics, and a DARPA leader. And we get together with our staffs and in the typical Pentagon matrix management, we all kind of get a chop at things and try to set the research direction. We do try to do things that are practical, things that may be trauma-related because NIH does not do a lot of trauma research. We do things that focus on that are not necessarily medical because we have plenty of people who have that expertise. And so we try to do the things that we do well and keep a sharp eye on what's happening in the civilian world so that we can quickly apply what they find, say, at NIH to what we're doing. But we have a big, even by ourselves, we have, as I say, about $1 billion research, biomedical research enterprise. So it's not trivial, and it's paid a lot of dividends.
Dr. Sells, it's been generally recognized that the DoD has played a key role in training America's doctors and clinicians for decades. with education training programs such as the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, as well as the Graduate Medical Education Program. Can you tell us a little bit about your efforts or thoughts around building the technical workforce of the future? And are you using any special programs or incentives to help retain some of the current staff that you have, as well as perhaps attract new ones?
That's a great question, Al. I really hadn't thought of it that way. There's no doubt that we have a tradition of excellence in trauma care and in infectious diseases. So Walter Reed himself, understanding the role of mosquitoes in yellow fever, Sternberg, Gorgias, all the great Army surgeons general who made tremendous advances in infectious diseases. Of the 11 adult vaccines in use in the United States today, 8 were developed by one Army doctor, Maurice Hilleman, including the first vaccine against influenza. So there's a long tradition in infectious diseases because we're deployed in tropical countries where these diseases are endemic. And we've played a big role recently in the past few years in monitoring and readiness for pandemic influenza, bird flu, and so forth. Trauma care is the other big area where the giants of American surgery, William Beaumont, Michael DeBakey, Denton Cooley, Don Trunke, Red Duke, the world's most famous surgeons, have mostly been trained in the United States Army. We've had 18 Nobel Prize winners who began their work in the Army, Navy, or Air Force. Some of them, like Jerry Edelman, Ed Krebs, Joe Murray, are alive today. Most of them did a few years in the military and then did their work at a university or a company. Each of them attributes his success in large part to the training and the inspiration of their military service. So we're pleased with that, and we try to get our young people to recognize that they have a heritage there. Going forward, Al, we are trying to have more interdigitation with university training. So as these wars wind down, we will probably have to look for trauma training in the big trauma centers, Houston, Miami, Baltimore, Detroit, places where there's ongoing trauma, to train our people. We also want to use our training program. For example, you mentioned the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda. Well, I call it America's Medical School. We hope also, though, to be the military medical curriculum for all of our allies. So there are 100 or so surgeons general who come to our annual meeting at AMSIS, the Association of Military Surgeons of the United States. And we hope that they will, that we will be able to deliver to them, as they requested, a curriculum that's webcast, showing the lectures that we give there in Bethesda so that they can take advantage of them, because we have, a larger military medical school than, say, Pakistan or Afghanistan. So we want them to benefit from what we're teaching. And there is a bond that comes from learning together, just like there's a bond that comes from grows between doctor and patient. There's a kind of intimacy that comes from that, and more importantly, there's a kind of trust. So we do want to do more teaching, and we want to use whatever technologies that we need that appeal to young people, whether it's Twitter or whatever it is. It would help us get their attention all over the world. People now use cell phones, and so it occurred to me when I was serving in Iraq, since we were not able to reach women in the more traditional villages, that we could at least reach them by cell phone. And in Africa, where there are very few landlines and very few television sets in the rural areas, still most people have a cell phone. So you, at least in the more prominent people in every village, have cell phones. So you can reach them, to teach them about health, about child care, about pregnancy, about clean water, about epidemics in nearby villages. You can give them alerts and so forth. So we very much hope that the cell phone initiative that we are developing in Africa will be a winner from the standpoint of the health of those people.
Those are great examples of using basic technology that we have today to really energize and drive changes in the healthcare system just about anywhere. What does the future hold for the military health system and DoD health affairs? We will ask Dr. Ward Cassells, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.